Hello, I'm Kate, and this is my Grieve Then Achieve podcast. In these sessions, we talk about death and dying, and so please do not listen unless you are ready for some rather frank conversations around grief and loss. But I do want to introduce you to some amazing people that have had significant loss in their lives, and they've then managed to work through that loss and use it as some form of a catalyst for change. So, if you're ready for that, let's go. So thank you, Julie. Thank you so much for joining me on the Grieve Then Achieve podcast today.
Hi, very nice to see you.
This is a really interesting conversation that we're going to have because this kind of rhetorical question comes up a lot in grief, but I'll let you talk about your journey. Tell us about your grief journey, because there's a couple of things to talk about, isn't there, today, really?
Yeah, so when you and I first started talking about this, Kate, I sort of said to you, I feel like I've had two quite different experiences with grief. So on the one hand, my mum was diagnosed with early onset dementia when I was just about 30. And we ended up living with that through that for sort of 17, 18 years. So she was a long-term dementia patient. And then on the other hand, my dad died completely unexpectedly, like on a sort of random Wednesday in September about 10 years ago. And I've noticed, I noticed in myself like a really stark difference in reaction. So eventually, you know, my mum died a couple of years ago, and the journey through that has been so completely different to the journey through, I guess, like my dad going. So yeah.
Quite.
When you were talking about it, I was like, oh well, there's something quite interesting in all of this.
Yeah, and two very different experiences. And that's the question that comes up. Is it, when there is no better with grief, but is it better to have some time to get used to things, or is it better to not have that time and not know what's going to come? And it's this kind of question that gets thrown around, and of course there's no answer to that, but you've had both experiences. You've had that anticipatory grief, and then you've had that almost traumatic grief, really, depending on how your dad died. But can you talk about the two differences and how you notice the two differences in the grieving process for yourself?
So with my mum, it was a long, slow, it was like, I talk about living grief when I talk about dementia, because it's a series of losses that happens. You lose bit after bit after bit after bit. And in our case, it was a very, very long time in coming. And interestingly, you kind of think like, oh, I've done my grieving, you know, because by the time that my mum was at her life's end, I mean, you know, she was pretty much catatonic. She had not moved out of bed for quite a long time. She'd had strokes. There'd been various kind of complications. And I was with her actually on the night that she died. I sat with her, which we can talk about too, because that's an incredible privilege, as well as coming with its own set of stuff. And then what happened in the aftermath of that was I just couldn't connect to it. I couldn't really kind of grieve. It was very weird. It was like a very different thing. There was relief in some of it.
Of course.
But yeah, I found myself almost waiting. It's like, when's it gonna hit me? Because when dad died, and he died of a heart attack, he was at home, it was fast and, you know, completely unexpected. And it was literally kind of a phone call from one of my brothers saying, dad's died. And I'm sorry, what? I'm sorry, what? Mm-hmm. Like, what are you on about? You know, how, what? And that was, you had to kind of get over the shock and the misunderstanding, and there was so much to get through. Whereas the preparedness with my mother, yeah, it was almost two completely different experiences and two completely different pathways through.
Do you grieve twice almost when you're in that anticipatory grief where you're grieving before the person's gone, and then you grieve when they've gone? So you're almost, and again, those processes are probably quite different as well.
Yeah, I talked about like sort of, or I still talk about, you end up living your life in sort of holding patterns. So with dementia, because there is no kind of, there's not a linear pathway through, and anyone who's currently on a dementia journey, my heart goes out to you, and everybody goes through that in their own way. Like your relationship with the person is very, very sort of salient to how you feel and how you respond to what's going on around you. So it's a very complicated thing. But I noticed that we ended up living in a series of holding patterns. So we would get to a point where we would have like the social care in place, and you know, the she'd be going out, you know, for the day to sort of day centers and stuff like that. I'm giving my dad some relief and some breaks. And this pattern would hold, and it might hold for 6 days, it might hold for 6 weeks, it might hold for 6 months, but you would kind of live in this pattern. And then while that was holding, everybody would go, okay, and go off and sort of do their own thing and have their own lives and do, you know, sort of get on with it. And then it would break down. And then when it broke down, quite often it would break down quite badly or quite suddenly. So, you know, she would just take a really bad turn, and all of a sudden the things that were in place just weren't fit for purpose anymore. And then you would have to kind of rejig. And so there's these mini losses, there's these sort of micro griefs that happen where you've just got to kind of work with the situation. And I learned so much in that time about living with uncertainty and living with ever-changing patterns, you know, and not ever trying to get too controlling about anything, just kind of going, right, do you know what? For now, we're just going to work with this as it is, N knowing that it wouldn't probably hold terribly well. And interestingly, since then, I've had friends and family members who have gone through other illnesses like cancer, and you know, and it's very similar. It's holding patterns, it's waiting for information. It's like, how does this hold? And then it changes. Okay, and then it changes again. So culminatively for me, by the end of it, you're kind of exhausted. You've kind of gone through it and through it and through it and through it. And I think that's where there can be elements of relief. But also, you live in this kind of state of semi-chaos. There's always like this little bit of you that's on high alert. There's always this little bit of you where the phone rings and you're like, is this,
Course.
is this, is this? And then when the person dies, the alertness takes a while to settle, you know? You're still kind of going, I could go just on holiday. Oh, okay. So it's really interesting, like how I felt I was really wired into that like life pattern.
Sounds an incredibly stressful time, like you mentioned, you know, exhausting because you're taking each day, even less than a day, probably hour by hour, aren't you? For as long as that goes on.
I mean, yes, and so I, like I said, we were working with this for 17 years, a bit more. So it sounds that this probably sounds like it was really stressful. It wasn't. There was these moments of like, you know, things, and then it would just settle and be like super normal. And then it would all sort of like unpick, and then it would go back to being normal. And then so there's it yeah, there's yes, for me, my experience of going through that was I had an alertness that was going on with me all the time. I don't know how that I know it's not like that for everybody. And I think one of the things around dealing with long-term illness and death and the that kind of living grief, that letting go of a person or letting go of a parent, it is such an individual journey. It's such a, like, you can't say to anybody, oh yeah, no, I totally know how you feel. I mean, you can be like, I have a sense of that, but if you're going to be really empathetic, if you're going to be really compassionate, n not putting your own stuff on other people feels really, really important. Because I can remember people telling me how I felt, or they would go be like, oh yeah, like yeah, so it's like this, and I'd be like, kind of no, but oh yeah, no, it's a wee bit like that, but like also kind of no. So it's, yeah, it's an odd one.
And then that in and the difference between that and your dad, where he just went. How
Yeah.
did you grieve for him?
Really badly. Yeah, that was a whole different. That was a whole different thing, because our family dynamic really kicked in then. Everybody, I'm the youngest. I have two elder brothers, and everybody was kind of vying to be responsible and know what to do. And it was very, very typical in our family. And we hadn't ever organized a funeral. There's three. Kind of, we were in our, I was what? I was 39. I wasn't even 40 at that point. We hadn't organized a funeral. We were all absolutely clueless. We didn't, just kind of all looking at each other, going, what, so what do we do? And like, we had to kind of phone older relatives, and they went, right, you phone the funeral director and you do the thing and you do the, and you're like, oh, okay, we'll just do the thing. And I phoned our family solicitor, who was amazing, and he just went, here are the things that you need to do in order to do the,
Yes,
okay.
there's a process and it's got to be followed, hasn't it? But no one, until you have to go through it, no one talks about it. And you can't do that until you got that, and you can't do that until you got that. And it's like, whoa,
Yeah. And
why
he'd
did we
like,
not know this?
right, okay. And like, he'd left no instructions, because like, he was in, I suspect in his view he was never going to die. So we didn't, and then it was like hymns, hymns, hymns. Does anyone, like, I mean, everyone's like, we probably knew things like the Lord's my shepherd, and we were like, no, we need to. So again, it was like on the phone to his mates going, oh, does anyone know, like, what? So it was just this kind of really kind of dull practicality around it, which again, anyone who's been through this in those first kind of couple of weeks, you don't really do anything other than just the thing. You do the process, you do the, the bureaucracy and the kind of all of that stuff.
The sadmin, as it's called, and that's so true, isn't it? The sadmin. It is.
Yeah.
It is so sad. It is the worst time.
And then I guess by, so he died in the September, and then by the end of October, it was kind of like, oh, okay, so that happened. Right. So I didn't register, I don't think. No, I know I didn't. I didn't. I just didn't register how kind of unhinged it made me. And I just continued. I carried on. I went back to work. I did stuff. My memory of that time is very, very fuzzy. And I didn't really, I don't know, I didn't really process it, I didn't really talk about it. I just carried on. I was like, he's died, we had to do stuff with mom. It was like all kind of right, okay, and it caught me in December. It was December, so I guess a couple of months in to all of it. And yeah, so I got up one morning and I went to make myself a cup of tea, and it was cold. It was December in Edinburgh, and I was kind of faffing around, And I just had this sudden urge. I was like very tired. And I thought, I'm just going to sit down for 2 minutes. I don't know why. And I would never, ever kind of do that sort of thing. But I remember like just having this urge to sit down. The kettle was on. So I sat down on the floor. And then the next awareness that I have, I was freezing cold and I was completely shivering. And I think I'd been down for about 2, 2.5 hours. And I hadn't fainted. I just stopped.
Wow. How did that feel?
No, I can talk about it now. But as somebody who's high functioning and who absolutely identifies as being a coper and somebody who'll just crack on and get stuff done, it was terrifying. And I now understand. So when people talk about like a breakdown or a, a collapse or whatever, like that happened. I stopped. And I didn't have my mobile phone with me. My phone was in the other room. And I managed to sort of, I got myself back up and I phoned a friend of mine, my mate Rona, because she's the most practical person I know. And she said that I was so alarmingly calm that she knew something was wrong. I was like, "Hi, how are you?" And she was like, "Okay, what's going on?" And then she basically came and got me, and yeah, gave me food and just we started from there. So the shock of my dad, and that the absolute inability to talk about it, the inability to like work with it, really, it stopped. It was arresting. It stopped me. It literally stopped me.
The body keeps the score, which is an amazing book, but the body holds it all, and you think you're peddling through life fine, and then it catches up with your grief. It catches up with you at some point, and it might be 6 months, it might be 6 years. And the trouble is, you don't, because you're so far removed from that event, you don't realize that it's actually grief that's got to you. So did you know at the time, because that you said sort of 3 months or so later, did you know it was grief? The beginnings of processing the grief and or no.
No, I don't think I recognized it as that. I think that came later. I was just very frightened. I was very frightened that I'd stopped because my MO is to just keep going. And the notion that something could stop me and that something was not within my control was a really, really, really scary prospect. And that took a while to work through, and what kind of saved me, I use that word advisedly, was my writing. So I just started to write. I wrote about how frightening it was. I wrote about where I felt I was, what I was doing, what I was not doing. Like I just had to get it out, and I didn't. I often found talking to people hard to do, especially like close friends and family. Everybody has their own, they're working with their own stuff, and so I didn't want to go there, and sometimes that wasn't terribly helpful. But it needs to go somewhere, right?
Journaling, I'm a big advocate for journaling, and I talk to people a lot about journaling as a way of getting your jumbled thoughts down, getting it out of the body. Were you journaling, or when you say writing, were you blogging, or what did that look like?
I was blogging at the time, but I certainly wasn't blogging. wasn't blogging that stuff. What was I doing? I was journaling. It was a version of journaling, yes. It was kind of just screaming onto the page quite often. So Natalie Goldberg stuff, the kind of wild mind writing, and just kind of going for it and really giving myself time to kind of let rip. And yeah, that helped a lot. And I don't read that writing. It's there. I probably could go back to it, but it's I know.
But you never have. So you write it and that's it.
Yeah, at the time I did stuff with it. So at the time, like I had some practice in place from when I did my master's. So there's like reflective stuff. I knew that you would write it, you should write it, and then kind of leave it a few days and then have a look at it and go, oh, okay, this is what I now think. So at the time, I think I did some work with it. But then I'm like, okay, like it's there, but I haven't ever really gone back to it. I don't know what it would look like. That'd be interesting.
Does your grief show up for you at all now?
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're now. I get emotional, I get sentimental, in a good way. I was very close to my father. Not so much with my mum, actually. So that was, that comes with its own set of stuff. But yeah, I'm like my dad, and we were close, and we got very close through my mum's illness as well. So I got to know him as an adult as well as a parent. So yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot.
It's amazing how it gets you, isn't it? And grief, and it just keep it you live with it, and the pain lessens, but there are still those triggers, or there's still those moments where it just catches you unawares.
Yeah, but I don't hate it
No.
because yeah, like he earned that, right? Like he deserves to be missed. He deserves to, have not to not be forgotten and to be remembered with that care and that sort of like, yeah. So I don't, when it comes, I tend not to fight it too much. And I think it's often a testament to the love that we have for people. It's a testament to the connection that we have with folk when we still feel it like further through and through. And I really held on to that, like in my, in his absence, I tried really hard to dwell on his presence rather than just the loss of him, the stuff that we'd all been given, the things that we knew because of him, the way that he'd raised us and stuff. I feel like that's a really important part to hold on to. So I don't mind when it rises. It's like, okay, that's cool. That's he earned that. He deserves that for sure.
It is unexpected, and that's the thing about grief. And you kind of you almost give yourself permission. And a lot of the work I do with my clients is giving them permission to grieve. It's okay, and it doesn't matter if it's a month after, 10 months after, or 10 years. You will always be grieving, and it's okay. And I think that's it. It's just taking the pressure off yourself.
Yeah. And also, like, we're often stuffy in this country about like how we grieve and the kind of the big emotional outpourings that you see in some cultures. Like we're not tend to like not don't do too much of that. You're allowed to grieve in bits. And I think that's interesting, which is why I guess like I found the writing really useful because nobody could censor me. I could just kind of be really sad and cross and scared and stuff. And yeah, that felt important, that outlet. Yeah.
Yeah, I read something the other day about, are you still grieving? Are they still dead? Yes. So yes. And I thought that's brilliant. Agreed. I get it. Yeah.
Again, like with my mum, because of the illness, there was an element of relief. There was an element of, well, I mean, the whole debate about, end of life, allowing people to make choices. The woman who raised me would have detested how she ended up,
Yeah.
and that hurts. That still hooks me. Because that n nobody ought to get to that stage. She couldn't speak, she couldn't walk, she could, it was
Yes.
really, she was tiny. She looked like a mummy. She was just skeletal, and yeah, it was awful. I mean, in the end, the night that she died, it was incredibly peaceful, and my mother, being my mother, held out until my brother lives in Worthing, and we were up in Fife in Scotland. It's a drive. She waited for him to arrive. She did not go before he'd arrived. She held up. So her stubbornness was there to the end, which I found very comforting. But there's a whole piece about the end of life for her, which was just not kind, really.
Have you made kind of choices differently in your life because of losing both your parents? Has it made you make any big changes? Do you think differently at all?
Yes, massively. The choice to live. I mean, it's not that I wasn't choosing to live before. I wasn't didn't spend my I'm gonna, but I definitely have a more like I have more of an appetite to do stuff and live well, and and with an element of sort of joie de vivre, because I'm kind of aware that like you might just drop dead on a Wednesday, or you might spend 17 years kind of slowly losing your faculties and stuff. I think I try to kind of eat well and exercise and do all of that kind of stuff as a result. Probably still drink too much.
Yeah, but we won't mention that.
Yeah, I also think it really it was very catalytic in my emotional maturity as well. So I'm definitely, I have done my 10,000 hours in terms of working with uncertainty, working with my emotions and other people's emotions through uncertainty, dealing with other people's shenanigans, with compassion, and meeting that without like it derailing my kindness. I think all of that stuff is definitely directly related to working with dementia over years and years and years, and then rapid loss. Yeah, I could. It was really interesting, because when I'm saying it's really interesting. Might not be. But when Dad died, I can remember like going through this period where I was afraid of my phone. I think I said this to you when you and I first spoke, where folk would ring because they were shocked and they were sad. And I was like, we were shocked and we were sad. And people would phone, and I noticed very quickly that there were like three responses. There were folk who would phone you and say, "I'm so sorry. Like, I was so shocked. What can we do?" There were folk who phoned and said, "I'm shocked. I'm sad. I can't believe it." I like totally centering their own grief. And you're like, okay, am I meant to say, oh, I'm so sorry that you're like, so that was all, I didn't know what to do with that. That would come in at you, and people would be like, oh my God, I'm really sorry. I'd be like, yes, that's okay. And then there was a kind of, there were a third set of folk who just w were stumped by the whole thing, but like wanted to just acknowledge, like just not, they didn't want to help, they didn't want to do it, they just wanted to let you know. And that was often, that was less phone calls actually, it was often cards and things. But yes, the I used to be terrified of my phone because it would ring and I would just have this little catch of like, who is it? What's incoming? What's the response gonna be? And it was difficult, you know, kind of working with other people's stuff. Especially when I was feeling so ill-equipped at dealing with my own. But yeah.
We just, this is the whole point of this podcast, to bring it into the open, because we don't talk about it, and it's going to happen to every single one of us and everyone around us, but we don't have these conversations around death and dying, and we're ill-equipped to know how to support someone because we just don't talk about it. So we're not educated in it at all. And actually, wouldn't it be better if we just talked about it and brought it out into the open?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, if you hear that, if you hear that someone's died, don't, like, comparative stories weren't terribly useful. Moment, oh yeah, like when my dad died, and you were like,
Speak to me.
I
Speak
can't,
to
literally, my bandwidth is like this, I don't have it. So if you yourself are grieving and sad, I would ask really kindly that you take that to, you don't take it to the person who's closest. You take that, you be sad, yes, you know, be upset and all the rest of it, but maybe don't take it to their wife or their family member. Talk to your friends, talk to other folk who knew it, like, yeah, dissipate it in other places, because yeah, that was a lot of, and I get it. I do genuinely understand why it happened and what people were trying to do, but sometimes it was, if you're walking down the street and somebody rings you and goes, "Oh my God, I've just heard, and I'm so sad, I'm so sad, I'm so sad," and you're like, "I'm standing outside a shoe shop, I'm about to have a meltdown.
Can we leave this? Can we park this?
Can we not?" And the thing is, like, as well, because you weren't sure if it was the funeral director or the lawyer or whatever, so you're like, "I
Yeah.
answer it. Hello." It's just
A
bad.
lottery.
I remember that so acutely. Like, I just had this hatred of my phone for ages. It was awful.
But
And so.
no one can tell you this as well. That's the thing, isn't it? Like, this is the thing about grief. We all have such different experiences with it.
Yeah.
And that's classic, isn't it? Yeah, like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to get on the end of this phone. But you have to take those calls because you don't want to miss the call from the solicitor, because it'll be 3 weeks before you can get another conversation. So you do answer every call, even though you don't really want to.
No, it was deep, it was often deep rest.
So you have any? This is probably good time to sort of bring this to a close, to help. You've given some advice there, but any advice, especially from, I suppose, with living and dealing with dementia? I mean, do you have any advice? Because it must be so difficult.
Counterbalance. You need counterbalance. Is my lived experience. So fully engaging and getting into every aspect of the dementia will do you no good. You will be exhausted. You will burn yourself out. You will, it is not it only goes one way.
Mm.
And so learning to look after yourself and allowing yourself, giving yourself permission to do stuff, and not feeling insanely guilty about it is like, yeah, that I feel like that's really important, looking after your own well-being. And we talk about mental health and well-being. I have to say, when she was first diagnosed, so she was diagnosed in 2023, 20, 2003, I think. And we weren't having conversations about resilience and mental health back
No,
in
we really weren't, were we?
not really. And but I think that's really important now, like having counterbalance, good friends who you can say terrible things to, allowing your gallows humor to come through, because sometimes it is just like, oh my goodness, and you have to be able to go places and laugh and cry and do all of those things. But yeah, I think for me it was always, if I think about it now, it was the counterbalance always, that it just wasn't all consuming.
And that support is so important, isn't it? Wherever you get that support from, professional or friends, you need a community around you, whatever you're dealing with.
Both, I mean both, they serve very different purposes, but the professional spaces I think are really important, because often, again, being able to speak freely and being able to say things, there are spaces and places where that is easier, and there are places and spaces where it's not. And your friends ultimately are invested in you being okay and will desperately fight for you to be okay if they're good friends. If they're not good friends, then, but if they're good friends, they're invested in that. And sometimes you can see them like wanting you to be okay, and then it's really hard for you to not be okay.
And they want
Whereas
to
if
fix. Of course, they do. They want a solution for you, don't they? They want to fix and they want everything to be fine and
for
sadly.
all the best reasons. So that's where I think like the professional spaces, whether that's, the grief coaching that you do, or counseling, or death doulas, or whatever it is that's going to help give you the places and spaces to express, to settle, to have your emotions, that the old adage about have your emotions or they'll have you, like all of that stuff is just so important. Yeah, for sure.
Thank you, Julie. We could just talk about this forever, especially with the two different grieving processes you've been through. I mean, what a journey. But thank you. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to do it. It's like I say, this is not, yeah, this is not something I talk about very often. And it was, yeah, it's such a big part of my life, and it's such a big part of my, my growth, my development and stuff. That anyway, you made it very easy. Thank you. I
Good.
appreciate that greatly.
Thank you. Thanks ever so much. Thank you so much for listening to the Grieve Then Achieve podcast. And I truly hope that you've been able to take away some learnings around grief from this podcast. If you need any help or support on your grieving journey, then please do reach out to me. My website is grievethenachieve.co.uk. And you can find me on Instagram or Facebook under Grieve Then Achieve. Thanks again, and don't be alone in your grief. Reach out for the support that might just help you grieve, then achieve.